It is Monday, August 26th. I'm Michelle Martin from NPR News. It's Tell Me More. As the nation marks the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, Americans are sharing their memories and debating the work that remains.
A lot of the inequality that Martin Luther King was fighting for 40, 50, 60 years ago is still persisting today.
Political strategists Donna Brazile and Michael Steele are with us. It's the first of a series of conversations we'll have this week on the future of the movement. And former Education Secretary Rod Paige is among those who says education is a civil rights issue of our time. He tells us why and shares his vision for the nation's schools. Plus, we hear from Patina Miller. She filled big shoes in taking on a starring role in Pippin.
It was great for me as an actor to create this character that people thought they knew, but to be able to bring something different to it.
That and my tribute to our colleague Tashima Walker is all coming up. But first, the headlines.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Snipers opened fire on a UN vehicle in Syria today. It was part of a convoy of UN inspectors investigating the alleged use of chemical weapons near Damascus. NPR's Rima Marouch has details from Beirut.
According to the UN statement, the first car of the inspector's convoy was deliberately shot at multiple times by unidentified sniper. Activists say the attack happened in a no-man's land, in a buffer zone between government-controlled and rebel-controlled areas. The team is investigating Syria's opposition accusations that chemical weapons were used in an attack in Damascus suburbs last week. Rima Marouch, NPR News, Beirut.
The Syrian government says the sniper fire came from terrorist gangs. Meanwhile, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel says any response to the alleged use of chemical weapons by the Syrian regime will be taken in concert with U.S. allies. He says all options are on the table. Hundreds of firefighters are on the scene of a huge fire raging north of Yosemite National Park, digging trenches and clearing brush, desperately trying to halt its spread. In the past week, it's grown to more than 225 square miles, an area larger than Chicago, and it's only about 7% contained. NPR's Nathan Rott reports it's being pushed by strong winds and bone-dry conditions.
There are now almost 3,500 firefighters battling to keep the so-called rim fire from spreading at the rates it has been, doubling one day, tripling the next. But they're going to have a hard time of it. Lee Bentley is with the Forest Service, and he's been working on the fire for the last week, watching its behavior.
It's slopping all over. This fire has a mind of its own. It's like dropping a rock into a pond, and it just explodes out of there.
Nathan Rott, NPR News, Groveland, California.
The trial of Army psychiatrist Major Nidal Hassan enters the sentencing phase today at Fort Hood, Texas. The same jury found him guilty last Friday in the 2009 shooting rampage that killed 13 people. From member station KUT, Terrence Henry reports.
The jury will hear testimony from relatives of the victims. Each is expected to testify about their grief and loss. Hassan was found guilty of 45 counts of premeditated and attempted premeditated murder 4 years ago in a shooting at Fort Hood. Hassan continues to represent himself, and he is expected to give a statement during sentencing. He faces either life in prison or the death sentence. All 13 members of the jury must agree on the death sentence, and even then, there would be an automatic appeals process that could take years. The U.S. military has not executed a soldier since 1961. For NPR News, I'm Terrence Henry in Fort Hood.
The Commerce Department reports orders for long-lasting factory goods fell sharply last month, down 7.3%. Stock prices are moving higher. The Dow is up 32 points. This is NPR News. Afghan President Hamid Karzai arrived in Islamabad today for talks with Pakistani leaders to discuss the future of Afghanistan once all foreign troops leave his country next year. He urged the Pakistanis to help arrange for peace talks with the Taliban in Afghanistan. Taliban leaders have refused to deal with the Afghan government so far. The U.S. Open tennis tournament gets underway today in Flushing Meadows, New York. Rafael Nadal has a 10-match winning streak going into today's match against American Ryan Harrison, but he says he still has pain some days and a troublesome knee. Meanwhile, NPR's Joel Rose reports the Grand Slam event has plans to act a retractable ruse to its main courts.
The world's top tennis players are used to the rowdy crowds in Flushing Meadows, Queens, and the roar of planes landing at LaGuardia Airport. But lately, the weather has been the biggest obstacle at the U.S. Open. For the past 2 years, rain has forced the tournament to add an extra day. The United States Tennis Association has apparently seen enough. Earlier this summer, USTA President Dave Haggerty announced more than $500 million in new courts and improvements to its largest stadium.
Yes, as you've heard, there will be a roof on Arthur Ashe Stadium.
The USTA hopes to have that retractable roof in place by 2017, but for now, defending champions Serena Williams, Andy Murray, and the rest of the field will still have to contend with the weather. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.
A Wall Street pioneer died yesterday in New York of complications from cancer. Muriel Siebert started as a trainee earning $65 a week. She became the first woman to own a seat on the New York Stock Exchange. Muriel Siebert was 80. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Focus Features with the new thriller Closed Circuit, starring Eric Bana and Rebecca Hall, from the producers of Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, in theaters Wednesday.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. The nation is marking the 50th anniversary of the historic March on Washington this week. Tens of thousands of people traced the paths of civil rights leaders and foot soldiers in the nation's capital this weekend. On Wednesday, President Obama will speak from the Lincoln Memorial, just as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and other speakers did back in 1963. We are marking these events with a series of conversations this week. Later today, we'll hear about what many are calling the civil rights battle of our time. Education. We'll speak with former Education Secretary Rod Page. Now, though, we want to reflect on the role political activism played and is continuing to play in the March Toward Equal Rights. To do that, we've invited two prominent political thinkers. Michael Steele is the former Lieutenant Governor of Maryland. He's the former chair of the Republican National Committee. Donna Brazile is currently Vice Chair of Voter Registration and Participation at the Democratic National Committee. She's founder of the consulting firm Brazile & Associates. She ran the presidential campaign of former presidential candidate Al Gore, and they're both back here with us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Welcome to you both. Thank you both so much for joining us on this important occasion.
Happy 50th.
Thank you. In many ways. Yeah. Donna Brazile, you were tweeting this weekend about the anniversary, and in one of your tweets, you reminded us that you worked on the 20th anniversary of the March on Washington. You were 22 years old, and you were the youth coordinator, and I wanted to ask about your experiences then. And now?
You know, it was a remarkable time in my life. I graduated from college in 1981, and I had a job to come to Washington, D.C. When I got here, Coretta Scott King recruited me to serve as the National Youth Coordinator for the 20th anniversary of the historic 1963 March on Washington. Along the way, I worked with Stevie Wonder and others to make Dr. King's birthday a national holiday. I was a national mobilization director. Michael will remember this period of time. Back then, we had to come into the movement as young people, youth. And Eleanor Holmes Norton approached Mrs. King, and she said, "She's too young." And I said, "Well, who are you? You were young back in 1963. I was eventually promoted to serve as a national coordinator. Walter Funtroy was our leader, one of the national conveners. I was also a national convener representing the United States Student Association. But it was a remarkable period of my life because I was a very young activist and organizer from the Deep South, and Mrs. King gave me that opportunity to serve.
Did it feel like an important occasion? Did it feel like something important for the country, that important to do? Oftentimes, events as they are occurring don't feel as important as they do in hindsight. Do you remember what it felt like?
Oh, my God, do I remember? In fact, I shared with Bernice King the program, all of the activities that we sponsored in conjunction with the 20th anniversary. It was very important because in addition to fighting for Dr. King's holiday, which we eventually, it was passed in Congress and President Reagan signed it, we were fighting to free South Africa. We were fighting for the renewal of the Civil Rights Act of 1981. We were fighting at that time for nuclear disarmament. So it was a continuation of the march that started absolutely, well, 20 years prior to that, but also a march that was even conceived back in 1941.
You know, our producer Amy Ta went to the mall on Saturday to talk with some of the thousands of demonstrators, and once again pointing out that this, you know, young people are have always been central to these kinds of public events. I just want to play a clip from Alicia Williams from Virginia Beach.
I'm actually here in place of my parents, who grew up during the civil rights movement. They're both in their 60s. At one time, my father was actually banned from going to school for an entire year because they wanted to integrate the schools in the South. And, you know, being here lets me know just how far we've come in terms of the changes that have occurred, you know, since he was my age. And I just want to carry on the legacy and definitely carry on the movement because, you know, the issues here in this country are not yet dead.
So, Michael Steele, I'm going to go to you because you weren't here on Saturday for the march. I'm not judging that decision, but I am wondering.
Well, I was out of the country, yeah, so it's kind of hard.
is that because you feel that your role in advancing these issues isn't contingent upon marching? I mean, there was a time that as a person of your stature would have not wanted to not be there. And I wonder, is it because you feel that there are just that these kinds of marches just don't play the same role that they used
to? No, I think you're making a connection. It has no bearing on a family decision that we had to be away. So having said that, the fact of the matter is these marches still have some weight and carry some value to them. But I think you're going to see going forward a very different kind of response and reaction to how we engage. When I look at the millennial generation, and there are a couple of articles out today talking about how this generation connects and how they build the social networking. You didn't have a million people on the mall this week, past weekend. You're not going to have a million people on the mall on Wednesday, but you're going to have well over a million people connected to these events. And so while I was, you know, in Canada, I was still connected. I had it up on my iPod and my iPad and following it. Can't wait to get that text, that bill from my carrier.
But I think what you're saying is social engagement doesn't necessarily require your physical presence now.
It doesn't require your physical presence because your voice is still very much a part of the conversation if you want it to be, to whatever extent you want it to be. And so your physical presence, while is always great for the folks there in the room or on the grounds, you're still being, and I think we saw this with this weekend's activities, you're still able to reach a million more people who engage in a way that is very personal for them.
I just want to play another clip. Don, I'll go to you on this from Paul Heidemann, who attended the march. He's a 28-year-old young man from New York.
In some ways, it's a culmination. In some ways, it's a beginning of a process that's been building, I think, over the last, you know, more than a decade of anger at racism in the United States. And that's been really, I think, brought to a head by things like the verdict on George Zimmerman, which I think for a lot of people was, you know, basically a reiteration of Dred Scott, right? A black man has no rights. A white man is bound to respect.
That's a pretty harsh statement if you think about that. I mean, you're talking about something from the 18th century as opposed to a legal verdict in a case which was very traumatic for a lot of people. But Donna Brazile, how do you hear that? And what do you think that says about the current kind of state of play around these issues?
Well, the legacy of racism in America is still alive and well. We've done well over the last 50 years. We've done well in terms of civil rights, equal justice under the law. At the time of the 1963 march, we didn't have a civil rights law on the book.
Right.
We didn't have a voting rights law on the books. But what we continue to witness is the persistence of the criminal justice system to somehow or another dismantle, disrupt, and derail the lives of young African Americans, especially African American males. And the Trayvon Martin case, I could tell you as somebody who was, I walked among some of the participants, they were very young. It was an intergenerational march on Saturday, and there were a lot of young people with homemade signs saying justice for Trayvon. Trayvon, I think, the case, the nationally publicized case, really brought back to reality the notion that our criminal justice system is still not fair. We have a lot of work to do. And as we continue along this path of becoming a post-racial nation, I think something that Dr. King envisioned, we must be reminded from time to time that our work along the area of education, justice, and even equality, we still have to put our hands into it in our minds and souls and spirits and see if we can come up with a more perfect union.
Hey, Michael Steele, how about you? How do you hear that? I mean, obviously, as a political leader, you're in the hope business, too. I mean,
right.
Both of you are. You're in the business of believing that your work and the work of others joined together can make things better. But and you hear a comment like this, does this put you in a hopeful frame of mind? Or where are you in your sense of where we are and the issues that are at the central core of the march?
I think where we are is a few miles further down the road than where we were in 1963, but not by much. When you look at the, particularly for African Americans, and then I took from that statement, this underlying sense of, yeah, people talk about progress, but a young black kid was still killed carrying, a bottle of tea and some Skittles, profiled, identified. I don't necessarily, conflate this into an Emmett Till situation, but similarly, and somewhat ironically, back when Emmett Till was killed, it really was one of those moments that sort of catalyzed for a lot of people what would then grow into a civil rights movement. And I heard in the comments that and certainly saw online. Comments that were reminiscent of that in the sense that it has a galvanizing aspect to it. That young people see this. They see themselves reflected in this individual in some way. And so when they hear this conversation about progress, while they are totally disconnected from, the water hoses and the four white only signs, they experienced a different kind of racism, a different element of or aspect of it that they sense that we may not necessarily recognize. And so I think that their voices are going to be very prominent in sort of defining this next alliteration of the movement. I note, and Donna Brazil brought a prop in today to show us what I think is profoundly historic and important for what it says. Two things. One, we still have a dream. And I think that is so profoundly important given the work that someone like Donna Brazil did back in those days to organize, to recognize today that she's still able to help this generation fashion that dream. But below that, it talked about jobs. And today in this environment, jobs are still the driver for a lot of young black folks sitting at 12-13% unemployment rate in the black community as part of the national conversation that's not being had. So I think that when you listen to these comments, I think that's sort of the elements beneath it that kind of drives it.
So much more to talk about. And what Michael was referencing is the fact that you actually brought a poster from the 1983 march and a poster from today. The weekend's march and jobs is prominent, or both of them. So much more to talk about, and I'm sorry that we don't have time to dig into all these important issues today, and I hope you'll come back and continue these important conversations. Michael Steele, the former chair of the Republican National Committee, Donna Brazil, former campaign manager for the Al Gore presidential campaign, and a prominent official with the Democratic National Committee, both here in Washington, D.C. Thank you both so much for speaking with us today.
Yep.
Thank you.
Coming up, we are continuing to mark the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. You might be asking your parents or grandparents, were you there? 94-year-old Washington resident John Tatum was. We'll hear his compelling memories of life in segregated D.C. That's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. In a few minutes, we'll hear memories of life before and after the civil rights movement from a gold medal-winning senior athlete. That's coming up. First, though, we are continuing our coverage of the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington by talking again about one of the issues that's always been a central concern of the civil rights movement, and that is education. Leaders as diverse as Martin Luther King Jr. to Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama have all referred to education as a civil rights issue. Tomorrow, we are going to spend the hour talking about what that means. We hope you'll join us on the air and on Twitter using the hashtag NPR EdChat. But joining us now is somebody who spent his career working on that issue. Rod Page was Secretary of Education under George W. Bush from 2001 to 2005, and he is with us now. Mr. Secretary, thank you so much for joining us once again. We appreciate it.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Your most recent book is titled The Black-White Achievement Gap, Why Closing It is the Greatest Civil Rights Issue of Our Time. Now, as we mentioned, you're not the first person to say that. You probably won't be the last. But I just want to ask you, why do you say that?
Because I actually believe that our goal for advancement for African Americans, freedom, equity, social justice, cannot be completely achieved unless we close the achievement gap, unless we elevate the level of education of our young people.
Why is it that, given that we have leaders, as we said, from Barack Obama to George W. Bush, I mean, even during the first Barack Obama's first campaign for the presidency, John McCain, the Republican contender, also said that education was the civil rights issue of our time. The former head of the NAACP legal defenseman, John Payton, said that. Why is it that we seem to still be at loggerheads under some of these fundamental issues?
I think because some of the issues that we fought against have been so terrible and so awful that we can't quite get over it. And what we have now is a situation where our strategies to achieve our goal, social equity, is not aligned, and freedom is not aligned with the situation that we exist in. So we're still feeling the pains of previous years, and we've not quite gotten over it. But we need new strategies, and a new strategy would be elevating the educational accomplishment of our young people.
Now, your efforts, the Bush administration's efforts in this regard are kind of encapsulated as the No Child Left Behind effort. It was controversial then, controversial now. The current education secretary, who we're going to hear from tomorrow, wrote an opinion piece in the Washington Post calling it outmoded and broken. Now, certainly the goal of this was laudable, which is to say that you can't hide the lack of success with certain groups under the rubric, you know, of all of them. And yet we don't seem to have attained any movement here. And I wonder if you, first of all, do you agree with my assessment in closing the achievement gap? And why is it that we haven't?
Mm-hmm. I think we have attained some goals. Mm-hmm. And first, but it needs to be clearly understood that the No Child Left Behind Act was obviously led by President Bush. But it was a bipartisan effort to pass the act. It was a lot of cooperation between all parts of the Congress. And it was really supported strongly. It just fell apart as we got into some of the power groups in the education field that worked hard to defeat it.
Is this a question of differences over values? Is this a question of differences over resources? Because it would appear that most people do agree on the goal. Most people seem to agree with you and with the former administration, with many, many other people, that you can't have a successful society in which people are achieving at vastly different rates or are not able to meet standards, necessary standards, at similar rates. And yet, there still seems to be this intense disagreement about how to get there. Is this a question of fundamental differences in values, or is this a question of willingness to do what's necessary?
I don't think it's a fundamental disagreement in values. I think our values are pretty strongly aligned, but it's a formal, I think, disagreement in tactics on how to get there.
And so what would bridge that gap in your view? What would make a difference in your view?
Well, I think there's some exciting things that are happening out there right now that would make a big difference. One would be choice, school choice. We see a lot of charter schools now that are really teaching us new things about education and also making the point clear that all children can learn. We find children in many of these schools who are really excelling, who heretofore we thought were not going to excel quite as well. So we're learning a lot from that. I think the more that we support authentic choice, would be to our benefit.
As you sit here now thinking about all the work that you did and all the work that remains to be done, and clearly it continues, it concerns you because you wrote, you know, another book about it, are you mainly optimistic or are you pessimistic that we'll actually, we'll ever get to the point that we want to get?
No, I think I'm optimistic. There are some problems that we got to overcome, but I think I see on the horizon some things that are going to happen and are beginning to happen that gives us a lot of hope. I'm excited about what we're learning, as I explained before, from charter schools. I'm explaining about the development of choice that it goes across the United States now. I'm really excited about the fact that parents now are beginning to be dissatisfied with a lot of the operation of our traditional systems and asking for our better systems and asking for better support and asking for a system that would help their children achieve.
Well, but parents have been dissatisfied for quite some time now. I mean, particularly minority parents. If you consider one of the signature legal cases of the Civil Rights era, which is Brown v. Board of Ed, it was all about education. I mean, that was 50 years ago. So yeah, so see, people have been dissatisfied for quite some time. At what point do you envision them becoming satisfied?
Only when that dissatisfaction translates itself into action does it matter. You can be dissatisfied and don't act, and it doesn't matter. And what we see now is more action taking place.
If you could wave a magic wand that would cause this country to move in any particular direction, where would you wave that wand? Would you want to see a march on Washington for education? What would you want to see?
Well, no, I would, in the first place, I think the key to the whole thing happens at the magic moment when the teacher and the students come together. I'd like to see stronger support for teachers. I'd like to see them freed from a lot of the bureaucracy that they are loaded down with. I'd like to see parents support them strong and take more responsibility for the values that children bring to school. I would like to see all these efforts closer to where the real magic happens, and that is in the classroom where the teachers and the students connect with each other. National and state policy is obviously important, and we're spending a lot of resources and a lot of time there, and we need to do that. But we need more effort and more resources and more support for the magic place where the action takes place, and that's with the teacher and the student in the classroom. We have to change what happens in the classroom.
Rod Paige is a former U.S. Secretary of Education. He served in that post from 2001 to 2005 under President George W. Bush. He was kind enough to join us from member station KUHF in Houston. Mr. Secretary, thank you so much for speaking with us. I hope we'll speak again.
Well, thank you.
You can tune in to... You can tune in tomorrow for our one-hour Twitter Education Forum. You can join the conversation now on Twitter at hashtag NPREdChat. We return now to our coverage of the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. The civil rights movement was more than an idea or a series of events. It was a major force that changed the everyday lives of millions of Americans. A perfect example of this is John Tatum. We recently spoke with a 94-year-old athlete about competing at the National Senior Games. That's an achievement that is captured in the film Age of Champions. Tatum also attended the march in 1963, and he told us about his memories of growing up in Washington before the end of legalized segregation.
I was thinking about it on the way over here. Sometime in the near 1925 era, I was probably 5 or 6 years old. I remember standing on the corner of 22nd and Virginia Avenue, Northwest. That year they had the Klan convention here in Washington, D.C., and I, as a man, I just wondered how they could allow them to do that, but they had a Klan convention. I remember standing on the corner with my mother's hand, and we watched the Klansmen on horseback taking their steeds back to the stables down where the Watergate is now. Down in there, we have a lot of stables down in there. And they must have had a parade on Constitution Avenue, and just to see that and asking what it was about. And I don't remember the words I got from my mother about what the Klan was about. She didn't seem frightened enough at the time, and neither was I, because I didn't know. But, I mean, that's about the earliest things that I could remember in the stages of segregation, because I still remember 1926. I was in the first program of Negro History Week with Carter G. Woodson. I remember seeing him personally, you know, at the school, and talking about civil rights, and he was supposed to recording all of the Negro history at the time. And it was really a Negro History Week at the time, and that was all it was. And we had programs all during that time, but...
You also were telling us when we spoke last that one of your memories was of teaching your grandmother, who had been an enslaved American, how to read. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I was trying to tell her, and I really, as a boy, I didn't understand why she didn't comprehend. But we had, your parents and grandparents were in the house as long as they lived. There was no Social Security. When they finished working, that's it. They would be told just to go home. But I tried to teach her how to read, how to spell, or what this name was. But she was amused, but I didn't think she ever got to know really how to sign a name.
Did she ever talk to you about slavery? Do you remember any of those stories?
No, I don't remember, but my granddaddy did. He used to tell me things about, horses. He had to draw the horses up, and he used to try to learn how to read from the white kids. He would, mark something in the sand and tell them this and ask him how to spell this, and they write in the sand. But he never learned how to read from them because I guess the older people would probably be not, reflective of that. So,
do you remember what it was like when you realized what slavery was?
Yes, I think that came along the same time when Negro History Week come. We were so into our own thing. We were there in that area down by the Lincoln Memorial. We lived down that way, and we had our own schools and segregation so far as theaters and movie houses and all. The only thing, you never had a trouble with transportation in the city. You could always ride the bus, streetcars, and horseback and all of that.
Do you remember a happy childhood growing up in Washington or not? Or were there times when it wasn't?
I had a happy time the whole time until, I found when the barriers start to reflect it on you. As a kid, none of these things bother you. But when you get up and you can't do this, you can't go in that playground. You can't go to that school. In a school, you read books that were handed down from the white schools with the names and scratches of what we read, and we had the best teachers. Our teachers were people you looked up to like they were presidents or kings or something, mostly women. I don't think we had any man teachers during my time, but mostly women, and they dressed well, they smelled well, and they taught well, and they never let you get away with any crap.
Okay. I'm speaking with John Tatum about his memories of his 90-plus years growing up in Washington, D.C. You were at the March on Washington,
you were telling us.
What were your memories of that day?
Well, I thought it was quite a tremendous thing. I walked from, up by the Treasury Department down to Constitution Avenue and got in line, and I was just surprised at the number of people that were in the line. I worked in a computer group in the Navy Yard, and we were all off that day or something. And none of my counterparts came to the march. But in the line, there were whites beside me, behind me, front me, walking just like I was walking. And I thought this was a day that would live, in our memory. And I never got up close, but I was in the trees and I always thought about that. Some of the people along the reflecting pool they saw, and some people standing in the open, they see, well, people under the trees all the way as far as the eye could see.
You knew even then that it was a big day?
I knew. We had a million people down there, and it was a big day. And the speech, I didn't know how famous it would be at the time, because Martin Luther King speaks very well. Some of his speeches were tremendous, especially the one the night before he was murdered. That speech, that was really a heavy speech also.
But you're saying that I Have a Dream speech at the time, you thought, that's a pretty good speech, but not one of his best, is that it?
Right, and I didn't know it would...
You gave it 2 stars?
Yeah, instead of 3.
Instead of 3.
Yeah.
Do you remember, I don't know how you would not remember this, but many people will remember that after Dr. King was killed, that there were riots in Washington. Do you remember that?
Yes, that was my birthday, uh-huh. April the 4th, 1968. And we were coming out of work that day. They let us all off that day. And to come up to see what was taking place, the fires and the looting and stuff like that, that was quite a day. Martial law was in place, And then we were locked down for a while. So,
and you've lived through that, and you've lived to see an African-American president
yes.
and an African-American family in the White House. I have to ask honestly, did you ever think you'd see that in your lifetime?
Not in my lifetime. I did after, you know, he was up for nomination. And all. I thought that was a possibility. But up until that time, you know, I never, not just Obama, but a man, you know.
Do you mind if I ask, how did you feel when he did become president? Do you remember how you felt?
I didn't know what to think about it at the time, but just to know that this is a possibility. I felt the same way that the third world companies felt about it, that they never thought the United States would allow that to happen. And I didn't think it would allow it to happen. But now we will see what a black president could do, the same as any other president.
When you think back over your long life in Washington, D.C., what's your happiest day and what's your saddest day, if you don't mind my asking?
Well, the saddest day, you know, you're losing family members, especially your spouse. Mm-hmm. And then your children, you know. Those. And my happiest days is to be able to find work, although not what I would like to be, you know, segregation and bigotry and all that. I don't know what I could accomplish if I had a better chance at life and a better education. But I would say to finish my life having, to myself, of course, done the best that I could do for my family and for the people around me.
John Tatum is a lifelong resident of Washington, D.C. He is 94 years old, and he was kind enough to join us from our studios here in Washington, D.C. John Tatum, thank you so much for offering those memories and reflections.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Switching gears, now we head to Broadway. Patina Miller won a Tony Award for her performance in the 2013 revival of the musical Pippin. She'll talk to us about her rapid climb to stardom.
I always knew that this is what I was going to do, and I was going to stop at nothing to get what I wanted.
Patina Miller tells us more about her sacrifices and success. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Arizona State University Online, more than 60 undergraduate and graduate online degree programs at radio.asu.edu. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And from Allstate, committed to helping people live the good life every day. Allstate, good hands for the good life at allstate.com/good. This is NPR.
Education Secretary Arne Duncan is joining our education broadcast and Twitter forum. He'll answer questions from teachers, parents, and you.
Are there plans to ensure that teachers are able to keep up with technology as it changes?
Add your voice on Twitter at #NPREdChat. That's next time on Tell Me More from NPR News. Thank you. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Later in the program, I want to share some words about my dear friend and colleague, Tashima Walker. She was the executive producer of this program, and as you might have already heard, she passed away recently. I want to share some thoughts about her in just a few minutes. But first, a special conversation with Tony Award-winning actress Patina Miller. She first got noticed on the theater scene in 2009 as the star of Sister Act, a divine musical comedy. She earned rave reviews for playing the accidental nun who led a choir to stardom. Now Patina Miller takes center stage again in the Broadway revival of Pippin. The musical first launched in 1972. Miller takes on the role of leading player, the circus artist who guides a young prince in finding meaning and magic in his life.
We've got magic to do just for you. We've got miracle plays to play.
That was Patina Miller singing Magic to Do in Pippin. Miller won this year's Tony Award for starring in the revival. You can also hear her on the newly released CD of the show's songs, and she is with us now. Welcome. Congratulations on everything.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. It's good to be here.
How did it come to you to play the leading player? I think many people will remember that that was a role originated by Ben Vereen 40 years ago.
Yes, well, I had worked with the director, Diane Paulus, before in 2007. Then I got a call from her after I left Sister Act in 2011, and she was telling me that she was going to revive Pippin and that she had this idea for the leading player to be a woman. And that, like, immediately sparked my interest. I thought it was so clever and so amazing, you know, to do a revival and think of it in such a different way. And that's just the kind of director she is. So, you know, she called me and told me what she had in mind of what she wanted this character to be and asked me if I would come in and audition. And I did, and the rest is history. I'm telling you, it's been the most amazing experience of my life.
Well, speaking of history, I believe this is the first time for this role that a woman and a man have each won the award for the same character.
Yeah, that's pretty insane.
It is, and I was wondering, following Ben Vereen, did it make it better or worse that you are a woman?
You know, I actually have to say, a lot of people were excited for me to do it, and you know, I'm sure there were tons of people who were like, no one could ever top Ben Vereen. So I came into this process with the challenge, a really big challenge, is how do you make Pippin different, but also how do you take people's minds off the fact that, you know, people come in expecting Ben Vereen. And that's why I think Diane is so smart, and that she completely made it so different and making the leading player a woman, so that you can kind of go in, you're not going to see Ben Vereen, you already know you're not seeing him, you're not seeing another man, so you can't compare it to that, but you can see it through the eyes of something different. And I didn't really know Pippin that well, so I could come into it, you know, it's like a blank canvas. I could just make this world my own, and there wasn't something that I had to compare myself to. And so that's kind of how I threw myself into it. And it was great for me as an actor to be able to create this character that people thought they knew, but to be able to bring something different to it.
I want to talk a little bit more about Pippin in a minute, but I did want to ask, this is the second time that you have taken on a role that other people may have already formed opinions about, because you played the same character that Whoopi Goldberg played in the film version, you know, of Sister Act, and you were a relative newcomer at that stage. I mean, was that hard? I mean, did people come in expecting to see Whoopi Goldberg?
You know, to be given a role like that at 24 years old, having never led a company, and to go over to another country and perform by yourself and lead the show, and you know, people love Whoopi over there. So it was frightening and scary. But at the end of the day, I really wanted it so much. And I wanted the opportunity to be able to just be an actor and find my way throughout this piece and make people see that, you know, you're not seeing Whoopi, but you're seeing a performer who is giving her all and making you have a good time. And hopefully in the end, they forget about it, you know?
You talked to Whoopi about it, though, right?
Yes, I did.
At one point, Whoopi, like, we're friends. Like, right, I'm actually, like, she's my best friend.
Yeah,
right?
Whoopi, but, you know, like, I talked to Whoopi.
Exactly. Was she nice about it?
Yes, she was the most down-to-earth person ever. I met her right before I went out to London, and she just let me know she was there for me every step of the way, and she knew that it was going to be hard for me stepping into her shoes, because she knows, you know, Sister Act was a huge film. But she told me to just do my thing and to forget about what other people think about it. Don't be afraid, but use it. And that's exactly what I did.
It would have been really rough if she'd gone the other way and go, yeah, oh, girl, God, you just cannot possibly, you know.
Well, that would have been awful. That would have just,
I think I would have cried
in a corner or something.
Like, really?
But I would have pulled it off.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Tony Award-winning actress Patina Miller. We're talking about her role in the Broadway revival of Pippin and also about the rest of her career. I want to play another song from Pippin. This is a bit from your solo, Simple Joys.
Sweet summer evenings, sapphire skies, feasting your belly, feasting your eyes. Simple joys have a simple voice that says time is living's prize. And wouldn't you rather be a left-handed flea, a crab on a slab at the bottom of the sea, a newt on the root of a banyan tree, or big on a twin galley, than a man who never learns how to be free? Not till the day, not till the day, not till the day, not till the day.
Couple things I wanted to ask about that. First of all, this role is very physically demanding.
Yes.
I mean, you can hear it's vocally demanding, but it's physically demanding. You spend a lot of the time, like, literally in the air.
Yes.
Performing on a, what would you call, a high wire? Or
a trapeze.
Yes. So that's the first thing I wanted to ask, which is, how do you keep yourself together to do that 8 performances a week?
Well, the good thing is before I started to take lessons on trapeze, but I also started to really get into fitness, getting into being healthy and taking care of my body. So about a year ago, I mean, I've always been physical and everything, but I wanted to really start getting into figuring out how strong I could get without bulking up. And so I started taking personal physical training and nutritional things with these trainers at Mark Fisher Fitness here in New York City. And I really got into it, something that I really love to do. And the one thing about my character I wanted was for my character to be really strong. I wanted her to be able to hold her own. And a lot of that, you know, flying in the air, it's not easy. You know, I'm very strong, but I was strong in a different way. So I had to find a way of building muscle in a different way to be able to hold my body weight on the trapeze. And I'm dancing a lot. I'm doing a lot of Fosse. It's nonstop physical movement the entire show, and also singing in this big emotional arc that my character goes through the show. So I just wanted to be prepared mentally, physically, to be able to take on the role.
Do you have to take steps to preserve your strength and voice that perhaps friends and family don't quite understand, like not speaking on your day off, for example? And
Yes. There are days where it's like, you know, I know what I need to do tomorrow. So I you know, I come home and I crash. Being on this journey for 2 hours and 30 minutes, and some days, you know, you do it twice in a day, could be very taxing on your body and on your voice. And so I really have to be strict about the things that I do. But, you know, I've learned throughout this process that I'm stronger than I think I am. It's allowed me to not have to be a nun like how I was in Sister Act.
Well, do that. I mean, do you literally, like, not go to parties? I've heard Broadway performers say they don't go to parties because they can't afford to project over the crowd noise.
No, I mean,
So, you do go or you don't? You don't?
No, I do not go to parties. I mean, no, not at all. I don't go to parties. I don't really go to bars. And, you know, it kind of sucks sometimes because your friends want you to go out, but they understand that, you know, if I go out right now, I'm jeopardizing what I have to do at night. And listen, I love what I do so much, and I don't want to jeopardize that at all. So I like taking care of myself because I like being on stage. I've been giving a great opportunity to do what I love to do 8 times a week. I don't want to mess that up.
One of those weird ironies that here you are like the toast of Broadway, but you can't go out.
I know, right?
You have to go home and drink tea.
I know. Our opening night party was so amazing, but the entire time I'm like whispering in people's ears. Just like, you know, you have to talk to so many people on your opening night and everyone congratulating you and you're so excited. But like, you know that you have a show to do tomorrow and it's like midnight and you want to have a drink, but you can't have a drink. I don't think I've really touched any alcohol or anything else. I haven't been social in the way that I used to be social, but that's kind of one of the things that you sacrifice for something that you want to do.
Interesting, though, because Pippin is in part about what would you do to be extraordinary?
Yeah.
What risks and sacrifices are you prepared to take to be extraordinary, to really understand who you are meant to be, you know, in this world? When you think about the path that you've taken, you were Tony nominated for your first major role. You won for your second major role. Great and amazing on the one hand, but on the other hand, is a little scary because you kind of feel like, what do I do for my follow-up? What's my next thing?
Yeah, those are the things I think a lot of actors go through. I mean, after Sister Act, I remember thinking to myself when I left after my last show, and I had been working since 2000. Well, since I graduated, I've been working nonstop. And so after that all ended for me in 2011, after such a long time, I went into like a depression of, was this a mistake? You know, was this going to be my only show? Did this happen by accident? And I started questioning myself and my ability. And luckily, I have an amazing mother and an amazing fiance who really just kind of like, you know, talked me off the ledge a little bit and was like, stop this, you know. You haven't had a time to rest for a long time. Like, this is a good thing. And as soon as I stopped being depressed about, gosh, people are looking forward to what I'm going to do next. That was the question, right? When people saw me, oh, so do you have anything lined up? After that moment, I think I left in March. In June, Diane called me about Pippin.
So you never thought, oh, gosh, I should have majored in electrical engineering.
No,
I always knew that to fall back on.
I always knew that this is what I was going to do, and I was going to stop at nothing to get what I wanted. Like Pippin, who's on this journey as an artist, you know, I've always wanted to do this. I was going to stop because what my idea of when I was young of, you know, I'm going to be a star and how do I get there? So I went to school. I studied musical theater. I went to college. I was first in my family to go to college. And, you know, I've been working professionally. I've been doing all of these things. Now what's next? And I've learned during the show that just being in the moment, like Bertha says in Pippin, and experiencing, you know, the joys and all the other things of what life is now is enough, you know, because nothing's guaranteed. So why not just live in the moment? And that's kind of what, you know, my whole thing is now. It's just living from day to day, enjoying the blessings and what I get to do now.
Well, I'm going to let you save the rest of your voice for today. So
thanks,
you for coming
Michelle.
In and sharing a little bit of it with us. Patina Miller is a Tony Award-winning actress. She portrays leading player in the Broadway revival of Pippin. The music and lyrics are by Stephen Schwartz. And she was kind enough to stop by our New York Bureau to speak with us. Congratulations once again.
Thank you.
Finally today, if you will allow me another word about our dear friend and colleague, Tashima Walker. I know that my colleague, Celeste Headley, who was sitting in for me while I was away, had the sad task of delivering the news last week that Tashima, the executive producer of this program, left this life a few days earlier after battling colon cancer for the better part of 2 years. But I thought it was appropriate as the host of this program and as a friend of Tashima's to say a few words myself. And let me say that I recognize that it can be hard to sit through tributes to somebody you never met. It's like those speeches at the Oscars where the winners are thanking people you never heard of and you wish they'd just get back to the music numbers. But as somebody said in a movie, no doubt, attention must be paid, especially to someone as vital to this enterprise as Tashima. And even more to the point, if you've been listening to this program at all over the past 6 years we've been on the air, then you actually did know Tashima. At some point or another, if you heard one of her occasional essays or responses to a letters segment or a blog post, then you got to hear that delicious deep voice, that delightful laugh, her hilarious expressions, her rigorous journalism infused by her incisive thought. But even more to the point, you knew Tashima because as much as anybody, she embodied what we as a show are trying to be. By that, I mean Tashima was specific and also universal. She very much lived her own story, but also was unendingly interested and looking for connection to everybody else's story. For example, here's a clip from an essay she wrote in 2007 in response to a scene in Tyler Perry's movie, Why Did I Get Married? That's where the character played by Jill Scott is demeaned by both a flight attendant and her on-screen husband for being large-sized and for having trouble fitting into an airline seat. Here's what our girl Tashima had to say about that.
Oh, it was too much. It wore me down. Michelle, let me borrow your line right here and... can I just tell you that I'm a black woman with an extra, extra large behind? And if I had a dollar for every time I saw a character in a movie where a fat black woman was an emotional victim, the center of a hurtful fat joke, the prayerful matron of all thin women and children, I'd buy my own damn studio and write movies about real everyday fat women. I'd write about fat women that love food and lick their fingers after eating a piece of chicken. I'd have modest fat girls and juicy fat vixens that wear tight short skirts with 5-inch heels. I'd have fat evil executives that shouted everyone to hell, and I'd have the lovable fat woman that had two men vying for her attention. Now, do I say all this to say that I or other fat women don't have moments when we feel sorry for ourselves? Have I considered diet pills? Yes. Hired a personal trainer? Yes. Do I consider any of the surgeries that would shrink my stomach and my buttocks? Sometimes, yes. But because this is my body and I love it, I've made some decisions. I want to be healthy. I will marry the man that loves extra, extra large me. And the next time a movie director or writer struggles to create a smart, funny, and fashionable fat girl, call a sister. I can help.
And she did all that. She did try to be healthy. She exercised and watched what she ate. She did marry a man who loved extra, extra large her. And she did help. Maybe not the movie world, but she helped us. She did push us and everybody else around here to try to ensure that all people are depicted in their complexity, and was not afraid to call anybody out, including me and herself, when we fell short. She pushed for hard facts and deep reporting, and most important in my book, she pushed hard to find gifted people in places where other people did not, which is why some of the most powerful tributes you've seen pouring in about her are from people whose work she championed and mentored, who've gone on to make important contributions to this field and many others. She wasn't perfect. She was still learning some things, as we all are, but she was, to use one of her favorite expressions, juicy, and she did not play no games. What I would not give to hear her say, "Girl," one more time. You can say it too, whether you are a big black girl with tiny braids or not. The next time you need some inspiration, some strength to give yourself a hug, try it on for size. Girl, Tashima would love it. And that's our program for today. You've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from John and Catherine Debs in support of NPR's new global headquarters and production center in Washington, D.C. From the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to help reverse childhood obesity, at rwjf.org, and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
Is 58 minutes, 35 seconds. U.S. Naval Observatory Master Clock at the tone, Eastern Daylight Time, 11 hours, 58 minutes, 45 seconds. Universal Time, 15 hours, 58 minutes, 50 seconds. U.S. Naval Observatory Master Clock at the tone, Eastern Daylight Time, 11 hours, 59 minutes exactly.